the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host, tanned and rested after a lengthy vacation. This is our first fresh podcast since our return. Thanks to Deborah Hoover, Mark Lewis, Gillian G. Hurst, and Stuart Smith. They're voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. You can do it, too, for as little as $5 a month. The links are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. While I was away, I was able to avoid the ugly debate about the debt ceiling. The Tea Party Shuffle, not to be confused with the old Teaberry Shuffle, but the Tea Partiers have been dancing on the debt ceiling, risking the financial ruin of our country in order to score political points against Barack Obama, and he performed in a tragic way. I want to comment on that. I do want to let you know that in the second segment of today's podcast, Jason Leopold returns, the investigative reporter from truthout.org, and he's got a blockbuster that broke while I was away about unconstitutional use of religion in training military officers, and the Air Force has changed its policies as a result of Leopold's report. That's coming up in our second segment. But as I said, I was safely ensconced in France, had a wonderful time. Some listeners wanted to know about my vacation. We took my 87-year-old mom and went to southern France. We were about an hour north of Aix-en-Provence, a little bit further north from Marseille, if you know the geography there. Had a terrific time. And while I did have internet access, I was off the grid as much as possible. Didn't read a newspaper much, watched a little bit of television, but I allowed events to unravel without my day-to-day knowledge. And as I caught up on the plane ride back, I have to say just what a shitty negotiator Barack Obama is. And this is not the first time I've criticized his skills in that area. Started with the health insurance reform that he considers the signature of his hope and change agenda. And it was botched by repeated compromises that he made with himself, trying to win the Republican votes that never materialized. And likewise on climate change issues, energy issues. Obama has attempted to strike deals by putting out concessions before the other side has even come to the table. And this came into clear focus last December when Obama caved on the extension of the Bush tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy. And like the debate over the debt ceiling, these deadline-driven creations of the Republicans are things that were predictable. Those tax increases, the expiration of them, the tax cut expiration, was a known eventuality for 10 years because that was in the original bill. Obama knew when he took office in January of 2009 that those tax cuts were going to expire. And he bungled the process of that, lamely attempting to use them as an issue in the midterm elections last year, but not allowing Democrats in the Senate, for example, to take a vote on those tax cut extensions so that the American people would have a clear idea of the difference between Democrats and Republicans. And instead, they held the vote until after the election, and in the lame duck session, Obama got hosed. And you could see it coming. The day after the election, when Obama went on TV and said he had taken a shellacking, he should have said that he would veto any legislation that did not cancel the tax cuts for the top 2 or 5%. Instead, he started talking about bipartisanship and the need to work all this stuff out. And he lost. And it was clear to me before I left on vacation that, number one, we would not cross the line into default. Even radical Tea Party Republicans are not that stupid, I hope. And number two, it was clear to me that Obama was going to lose. What I did not expect was for him, in this same scheme of negotiating with himself, to throw my Social Security and Medicare benefits on the table. Programs that are not directly connected to the deficit. They're only connected to the extent that if we had defaulted, we might not have been able to pay our obligations to Medicare and Social Security recipients. But they're separate funds, separate accounts from the general fund. And it was gross negligence and a betrayal of significant proportions for the president to unilaterally throw those issues into the mix. And fortunately, the final deal, and I think Nancy Pelosi had a strong hand in preventing any meaningful cuts in Social Security or Medicare at this time. And when I look at the way Obama handled this, it was inevitable to me that he would cave in. He started by asking for only 15% in new taxes, in new revenues, to approach the shifting target of $2 to $4 trillion in deficit reduction. And he ended up with zip, zilch, nada. And I expect that, given the weak Republican field, that it will take a miracle to deny Barack Obama a second presidential term. I certainly don't want any of the Republican field to prevail over Obama. I think that would be even more disastrous. But if we're honest and objective and we put aside partisanship and our political hopes, we've got to recognize that Barack Obama is a failure when it comes to leadership, on policy positions, and when it comes to contending with the bullies of the Republican right. And as I saw him duking it out with Boehner and Mitch McConnell, and I heard the way the president has characterized this, that this is a deal that's good for the American people and we avoided default. Well, default was an illusion created by radical Republicans who were willing to risk everything in order to hurt Barack Obama, even if it means hurting the American people and our economy in what they see as the short term. And it reminds me, I have four brothers. And I remember growing up, one of my big brothers would play a game with me. We'd be near the swimming pool. He'd take me out on the diving board and threaten to throw me in. And after I was sufficiently scared and I whined and wheedled and pled for my freedom, he'd back off and say, "See, I saved your life." Obama saved us from a threat that wasn't real. And in doing so, he squandered a lot of political support from progressives that he's going to need next year. And he seems to think that there is a whole pool of independent voters out there who will applaud him for being the adult. And I don't see it that way. Because those independent voters swing with a political base in most cases. And if you undermine the progressive base of the Democratic Party, then independents don't have momentum. They don't have a reference point. And it's hard to predict. Some will fall Democrat, some will fall Republican, some won't vote. And apathy, I think, is Obama's biggest enemy as he heads into political season next year. And he trumpets that we won't have to revisit the debt ceiling issue until after the presidential election next year. That may be good for him politically, but I think it rather nakedly reveals what his motivations were. First and foremost, preserve his own future politically, and then worry about the fallout to the nation and to the prospects for Democrats regaining control of the House and holding on to the Senate, both of which are very difficult to suss out at this point. It's hard to see the numbers working to where the Democrats can hold the Senate next year, and it's anybody's guess if they can regain control of the House. But with these policies, the continuing war in Afghanistan that's opposed by almost two-thirds of American voters, including many Republicans and most independents, the lack of focus on rebuilding jobs in this country, which is the central goal that we need to achieve to reduce the deficit. Because given that Republicans obstruct any tax increases, the only way to generate more revenues into the federal government is more workers. It's not going to come from corporate interests. It's going to come from middle-class workers. And a jobs recovery is not in sight. Now, one thing that I have some modest satisfaction about is that in structuring phase two of this deal, which is that if the super committee of 12 members is unable to come up with further cuts by the end of this year, that there will be automatic cuts in defense spending. On the face of it, I take some comfort because it has driven me crazy that we talk about deficit reduction, but we don't include the biggest area of spending that is ripe for cutbacks, and that is defense and intelligence. And so that taboo has been partly lifted, at least at the rhetorical level. But then we have to look at unintended results, unintended consequences. And one theory that the Democrats appear to be operating under is that Republicans will resist cuts to defense spending so vociferously that they'll come up with other cuts. And those are going to be cuts to health and welfare and entitlements and programs that you and I care about and think are vital parts of government service. And we have seen that to date, Democrats are unwilling to use their power when they've had it to cut defense spending. So it remains to be seen if this has opened the possibility of significant cuts in defense. Some of the projections used to get to the nearly $2 trillion figure of deficit reduction are based on projected cutbacks in spending in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as we beg the Iraqis to let us stay, and as we have no plans to leave Afghanistan in the foreseeable future, I think a lot of those are what they call rosy, forward-looking statements. So the bottom line is that this was one of the most ugly episodes in American politics in recent memory. It is a lose-lose-lose proposition. And in closing on my ramble here, I'll just say that fundamentally, this is the wrong thing to do. That even though the cuts in the current fiscal year are relatively minor, and the big cuts are really 2 years away in the scheme that was adopted, it sends a signal of disinvestment at a time when jobs are not growing. The workforce is not expanding. And the combination of these long-term cuts at the federal level with the more immediate cuts that are happening at the state level in California and, you know, 30 other states, these are Hoover economic policies, Herbert Hoover. And we are cutting government spending at precisely the wrong time. I support the notion of balanced budgets, not by a constitutional amendment, but by the work of our elected leaders. And for all my criticism of Bill Clinton on many issues, he did balance the budget, and he did leave a surplus, and we'd be in surplus mode today if Bush hadn't cut taxes and borrowed to wage war. And so Obama loses as a leader and as a negotiator. The Democratic Party is weakened because it has accepted the frame of the Tea Party activists, the radicals in the Republican Party, that deficit reduction is the most important thing to focus on. And we're all screwed because these moves are not good for our fragile economy. And as I speak to you on the 4th of August, the stock market has lost, I think, over 600 points in the days since this deal was adopted. I wish I had a happy, zippy way to end this, but I don't. Your comments are always welcome here at the Peter B. Collins Show. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com or fullofit at peterbcollins.com. I'd like to hear from you. Just 10 or 12 years ago, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs was a hotbed, like a frat house. Sexual harassment, problems with improper behavior, they were way out of control. And now, well, they've gone in the other extreme direction. I used to expose myself to people out on the streets. But now when I feel the urge to sin, I just fall down on my knees. And I sing, holy, holy, well, now the Holy Rollers are running the show in the United States Air Force, and Jason Leopold, the intrepid investigative reporter and deputy managing editor at the nonprofit news organization, truthout.org, returns to our program today. Jason, first of all, congratulations on an exclusive that actually caused the Air Force to change its policies.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate that. Yes, it was, I have to admit that the Air Force acted swiftly once the story was published in terms of suspending this program, this course, reviewing it.
And we'll get into the details in just a moment, but I wanted to offer a little bit of background because some of my listeners are familiar with Mikey Weinstein. Mikey is a real forceful guy and somebody who has taken on the Air Force in particular. And he is a former judge advocate general. He also has children who have served in the Air Force and attended the Air Force Academy. And the favoritism shown to Christians that his children experienced at the Air Force Academy, in part, led him to form the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, MRFF. And in that role, he's been interviewed on my programs many times. And he is a very persuasive guy when it comes to these critical issues of separation of church and state and religious freedom in the military extended to every member.
Yes, and he is incredibly passionate. And if anyone has heard him speak about these issues before, I think that comes across very well. You know, his passion for these issues, and particularly of exposing, you know, how rampant fundamentalist Christianity, in particular, is within the United States military. You know, the Air Force is the Air Force, especially, is notorious for it. But we've also seen, you know, particularly the Army, you know, since the start of the war, or the wars, rather.
Well,
how that's happening.
I just read this account in the recent issue, early August issue of The New Yorker, which is based on interviews with the SEAL team that dispatched Osama bin Laden. And the man who killed him reportedly said, "For God and country." Before he fired those shots.
Yeah.
And I find it deeply troubling and a step beyond the rational pale to attempt to combat extremism as, you know, practiced by self-styled Muslims with a kind of Christian fundamentalism that is construed by Muslim fundamentalists as a very serious threat.
It is. It is a serious threat, and you know what's also important to take note of, Peter, is the terrorist, because that's what he is, in Norway, who killed upwards of 70 people. You know, he had in his manifesto, he wrote a 1,500-page manifesto that drew upon right-wing figures here in the United States. Who influenced him. And there's, you know, the similarities in terms of, how would I describe it, the fact that we are, you know, talking about radical Islam. Well, there is also, you know, radical Christian fundamentalism, you know, of a certain, you know, evangelical bent that it also has it's very similar in terms of you know the way that the religion the role that religion plays, and you know, people should really be concerned about it. I think that aside from the troubling revelations that you know come out as a result of these documents and stories that we learn about, you know, there's also constitutional issues, and you know, unfortunately, those are the constitutional issues are the ones that seem to be underplayed a bit. You know, people, you know, will read the Constitution and say it doesn't say anywhere that you know that doesn't say anything about religious imagery or that you can't have a religion test, so to speak, even though it does state that. But you know, they're saying that there is no constitutional violation here.
Well,
so, you know,
that's
another part of the whole story.
As a secularist, it's very important for me that the Constitution is given priority and precedence over people's individual religious beliefs. But what we're seeing is that the pivot point was 9/11, and we're told that everything changed. And at that point, the Constitution appeared to become optional. It's okay to wiretap Americans in violation of the Fourth Amendment because, oh, we're keeping you safe. And if Osama's called, well, he can't call anymore. If he's calling America, we want to know why. And so we've slid down the slope. It's not simply gazing at the slippery slope. We've made progress sliding down it. And this is just another example where, as you're about to detail, religion is being used to train the officers who would fire nuclear missiles and to give them rationales or rationalizations for a decision that they might have to implement. So let's get into the story here. You published on July 27th, and what you detail is that there is a required nuclear ethics and nuclear warfare course or training session that all missile officers are required to take, and it occurs during the first week of training here in California at the Vandenberg Air Force Base. And what exactly is in that presentation, Jason?
Sure. Yeah, well, you know, let me just say that the these documents that basically were the primary source material in terms of me telling the story, about 500 pages that were released under the Freedom of Information Act. All of these documents pertain to a missile officer's, a nuclear missile officer's first week in training. And the within those documents, there was a 43-page PowerPoint presentation. And that PowerPoint presentation, nuclear warfare and nuclear ethics, was taught by a chaplain. Chaplains rotate out of these courses, and every missile officer, by the way, this is mandatory, so they have to take these or they have to attend these classes. And within this PowerPoint presentation, Peter, it's using the Old Testament, the New Testament, and a former Nazi SS officer to teach missile officers about the morals and ethics of launching nuclear weapons and war in general. There are quotes, passages from the from the Bible, which, by the way, have been totally misused and taken out of context. Passages from the Book of Revelation stating that Jesus, as a mighty warrior, quote unquote, mighty warrior, believed to be, some wars to be just. There is an emphasis on Christian just war theory, St. Augustine's Christian just war theory, again, taken totally out of context, and all to make an officer, feel comfortable if they are called upon by the president or his lawful successor, which is what it says in the documents, to launch nuclear weapons. And the interesting thing, to me at least, in these documents is that they're using Wernher von Braun. Wernher von Braun is a former Nazi SS officer. He's regarded as the the father of the U.S. space program. He's responsible for the V-2 rocket that was fired and killed scores of civilians and in Britain.
Right.
And they're using him not as. By the way, let me just add a little background here. Wernher von Braun was part of a top secret program known as Operation Paperclip, and Operation Paperclip was a military program that brought former Nazi scientists who were part of the Third Reich into the United States to work on the ballistic missile program and basically the U.S. space program. Much of it is still shrouded in secrecy. So, but they're not using Wernher von Braun, who, by the way, again, used slave labor, used Jews and French resistance fighters in concentration camps to build this rocket. They're not using him as a scientific authority. They're relying upon him as a moral authority to discuss the, you know, morals of nuclear weapons and the fact that it's that the United States is fortunate to have nuclear weapons.
Well, let me read the quote ahead. From Von Braun that you cite in the article from the PowerPoint presentation that's related to this ethics class, mandatory ethics training for missile officers. Quote, "We knew that we had created a new means of warfare and that the question as to what nation, to what victorious nation, we were willing to entrust this brainchild of ours was a moral decision." That's in bold, by the way. "More than anything else." That's what von Braun said in 1945. "We wanted to see the world spared another conflict such as Germany had just been through, and we felt that only by surrendering such a weapon to people who were guided by the Bible could such an assurance to the world be best secured." Now, this is fucking bizarre. Because, you know,
to say the least, Peter, it certainly is. And
go ahead.
The emphasis is in the document. There's a, you know, there's a bolded part in there pertaining to the Bible that they emphasize in these PowerPoint slides for missile officers.
Well, and to use him as an authority on any moral question simply undermines the moral authority of the people who are presenting him as a moral authority. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And you correctly cite Operation Paperclip. And I want to take a moment here because a few weeks back we interviewed Annie Jacobson, the L.A. Times reporter who's published an interesting new book called Area 51.
Right.
And the projects at Area 51, which included the U-2 spy plane, the stealth aircraft, including the stealth bombers that are in service now, and we think the new generation of unmanned aerial drones, all of this came out of the projects at Area 51, and Operation Paperclip scientists were deployed there. And
right.
She makes the point that there was a real competition between Soviet Russia and the United States in the years after World War II to recruit the top Nazi scientists. And the Nazis got a pair of guys, brothers, who are expected or alleged to be responsible for the craft that landed in Roswell, New Mexico, the Horton brothers. And the Roswell incident occurred in July of 1947. But Annie Jacobson in the book found a photo of the Operation Paperclip scientists who were gathered at Fort Bliss, Texas in 1946.
That's right.
And yeah. The picture, it looks like there are at least 250 in this photograph alone. And Wernher von Braun is in the front row, seventh from the right, with his hand in his pocket.
That's right, yes. I mean, it's fascinating. And I'm familiar with the book, and I haven't had a chance to read it, but I did hear your the program interview that you had. And I mean, again, this was all shrouded in secrecy, and it is true. I mean, there was a competition to make sure that the these scientists that the U.S. had control of them, and certainly with Wernher von Braun, where he's saying in this quote that they're using, we wanted to trust this technology, if you will, to a country that adheres to the Bible. I mean. He had a choice here, either going to the Soviets or the United States, and obviously the United States was for him the better choice because he was then able to work on the space program, which is what he wanted to do. But again, you just look at and I have to say, Peter, that the response I've received from people citing Wernher von Braun has been kind of mixed, and I will say that people have taken umbrage with the fact that focus on his former Nazi ties and failed to state that he was the father of the U.S. space program. But again, he's being cited as a moral authority. This is what the Air Force is using to train officers about morals and ethics of launching nuclear weapons. And it, to me, seems disturbing. I would think that others would feel the same way. But I should note that, you know, there are about nearly three dozen missile officers who, you know, were sort of outraged by this, you know, sitting through this PowerPoint presentation, which was between 90 minutes and 2 hours. And you know, they're being spoken to about, you know, what happens when you launch nuclear weapons. And obviously, we all know what happens. You, you know, kill thousands upon thousands of people. And, you know, what they have to do after taking this course, by the way, is they have to sign a legal document. And basically, this legal document, which was included in the documents released under FOIA by the Air Force, it states that, you know, if called upon to launch these weapons, you won't hesitate. If you know, if the president calls upon you to, you know, turn the key, you won't hesitate to do it.
And Jason, let's just briefly recap. A mandatory session where religious themes are introduced and the bizarre endorsement of Wernher von Braun for following orders, irrespective of, you know, whether you deem them to be moral or not. And then immediately you are required to sign a statement which essentially says that I accept the brainwashing that was just administered to me. And this statement is pretty powerful. Quote, I will perform duties involving the operation of nuclear-armed ICBMs and will launch them if lawfully ordered to do so by the President of the United States or his lawful successor. Now, this is a very powerful package, and in my view, it makes serious incursions on the individual constitutional rights of these officers.
Right. Yes, it does. And, you know, many of the officers said that, look, you know, we signed up for this job. Some of them did, you know, some of them are sort of, you know, just rotated into it. And if we had any issues, we'd, you know, take the time and speak to, you know, a chaplain or an ethicist or someone else. They didn't feel like they needed to have to be bombarded with, you know, religious imagery. And by the way, it's not as if they are discussing a wide range of religions. They're really focusing on, you know, Christianity. I mean, this is really, you know, brainwashing and indoctrination. And that's, you know, that's what they took issue with. And, you know, I should note that, you know, after this course is held, they are then immediately presented with the document. And there have been, you know, times when some of the officers I've learned after the publication of the story, you know, they would go through these you know, these ethics courses or just the, you know, the training in general, and they felt that, you know, whoa, I don't think I can do this. And then what happens, Peter, is that you know, they're either moved into, if they're lucky enough to get moved into another position, that may happen. But oftentimes, and I don't have the statistics, but they would more or less be kicked out of the Air Force, and then they'd have to pay back the, you know, the whole tuition, which could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well,
that then is an additional form of coercion that is immoral in and of itself.
Yeah, and it really is. And like I said, I don't have the, you know, the figures on it, but that's really what you know, what has happened in the past, at least in some cases. So you know, as Damon Bazzetti, who I had spoken to, he was a former missile officer, and he referred to this as the Jesus loves nukes, you know, training. You know, he felt that they were putting this, you know, that this was put together, that this was held simply to just, you know, make them feel as if, you know, God says it's okay. Jesus says it's okay to launch nuclear weapons and you don't have anything to worry about. Now sign this paper, you know. So, you know, he had, underscore to me how it's a very tedious job. It's not as if it's an important job, as you can imagine, but it's also a very tedious job. It's not he wouldn't describe it as a fun job.
Mm-hmm. Jason, one of the other angles that you explore in the article is the Catholic Church's so-called just war theories. And this produced a flashback for me because 40 years ago, when I was before my draft board, applying for status as a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War, the members of the draft board pushed back on me and said, well, you went to a Catholic school. You're a Catholic.
Right.
The Pope and the American bishops support the war in Vietnam. And I carefully argued that I had a different interpretation of just war concepts, and that I did not agree with the Vatican or the bishops. And it was very interesting. Again, here is a government bureaucracy, my draft board, trying to determine my fitness for conscientious objector status and linking it to my religious training, which wasn't voluntary, by the way. My parents made me go to Catholic school. Then trying to basically get me to comply with the higher-ups of the church here on Earth. And it was very interesting to see them try to wedge me in against the support that the Catholics were offering at that time for the war in Vietnam. So you did a little investigation of the current status of the Catholic Church's position on just war concepts related to nuclear missile launches. And tell us what you found.
Yeah, well, it's actually, it's funny that you mention that. I should note that, the Catholic Church, because they were mired in that in the sex scandal, the abuse of children, mm-hmm. that this was sort of overlooked. But last year, the Vatican representative to the United Nations, said in speeches in D.C. and New York that, quote, nuclear weapons are no longer just for deterrence. Now, nuclear weapons are no longer just, for deterrence, but have become entrenched in the military doctrines of the major powers. The Archbishop noted that conditions that prevailed during the Cold War, which is what is being discussed largely in this PowerPoint presentation, conditions that prevailed during the Cold War, which gave a basis for the Catholic Church's limited toleration of nuclear deterrence, no longer apply in a consistent and effective manner. So, in other words, the Air Force ethics training, relying on Christian just war theory, relying on the fact that Jesus loves nukes, so to speak, is untrue because the Catholic Church has a different position on it, and this is this information or this their position is, like I said, it was buried, so not many people are aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to note that, as I said, when we first started speaking, that the Air Force, this story came out on a Wednesday. I didn't find out until Friday, but they immediately suspended the program, and it was in place for 2 decades, at least more than 2 decades, and they're going to review it now. And first of all, see if they even need an ethics course. If they do, they'll just sort of remove the religious aspects of it. But it's really, really interesting, Peter, to see how people react to a story like this and watch the wide range of opinions and comments that surface as a result. And as I said, there are clear-cut constitutional issues. You're not supposed to sort of, mix religion or have a religious test in with this type of training, or just in general with the fact that our tax dollars are going to support this. So that should be out the window already. But people seem to feel that this is okay. This should happen. We need people guided by a higher power if they're going to turn the key. It's just funny how, or interesting, how much we've shifted in terms of what we're willing to accept, or what some people are willing to accept. I received an email from a senior Air Force officer who took a look at these PowerPoint presentations, and he was outraged. And this is a very senior Air Force official who said that who's ever responsible for this should be fired, and the person above him should be fired as well. This person noted that if anyone had issues with launching nuclear weapons, in their own private time, speak to a chaplain. Or the Air Force should have said, "We'll allow you to speak to a chaplain, a rabbi, or anyone else that you need to speak with about the ethics and morals of doing this."
And those who have no issue on that basis, would a Scientologist be able to consult with Tom Cruise?
I guess if you want to get a meeting with Tom Cruise, that would be a good way to do it, huh?
Now, Jason, you published this on Wednesday, the 27th. How did you find out that the Air Force had at least temporarily suspended this program?
It was 2 days later on a Friday, and I a couple of the Air Force officers that I've spoken to, and some who reached out after the publication of the story, sent me a note saying, "Hey, we're hearing some rumblings that this course has been suspended." And I, in addition to that, I didn't include it in the story, but some of the officers said that they were unable to access the story at Air Force bases after it was published. They were blocked from doing that.
Really?
So I was calling the Air Force Air Education and Command, who oversees this, to sort of follow up on that. And it was during the course of these phone calls that I was making that, I received word that the course was suspended, and the Air Force confirming that to be the case. So, it's the story that really resulted in a change of policy, and frankly, it's a good one. I think that the issue of religion within the military is something that has been rampant and has been exposed, to a large extent, thanks to groups like the Military Religious Freedom Foundation and others, but. The Air Force just seems to have a real problem divorcing itself from the issue of fundamentalist Christianity, proselytizing in general within the Air Force, certainly at the Air Force Academy and other places as well. So on Friday put out a follow-up story, and this week actually was when the mainstream finally picked up on it.
And Jason, I'm sorry to do this, because on so many occasions when you have shared with us the fruits of your investigative reports and your exclusive writing, we then ask, okay, how did the rest of the media treat this? And there are typically two responses. One is they ignore it, or they take it without giving you credit for the work that you did in exposing it. So what is, a week later now, what is the scorecard on how the corporate media has responded to this exclusive report?
Yeah, well, let me just say that, it's a story that received a lot of attention on its own before anyone else picked up on it. So we were, you know, a truth out. I was certainly very happy that it was a story that seemed to have made an impact. And after finding out that the Air Force suspended the program, you know, that was confirmed. The Washington Post picked up on it and provided truth out with credit in their story and a link to the original story. Numerous other media organizations did the same. So we're very happy about that. Interestingly enough, it was picked up by Gizmodo, which is a tech site, you know, one of the biggest on the net and on the internet. And so it's been appealing to many different audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday, yesterday being Wednesday, CNN picked up on it. The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, Barbara Starr, one of the Pentagon correspondents, reported on it. And, you know, once again, Peter, this is, you know, I sort of feel uncomfortable saying it because it sounds like I'm complaining, but it's really important since we are talking about ethics, right?
Yeah.
It's a course about ethics, so
uh-huh.
Let's get into ethics. You know, CNN picked up the story. They did a segment on it, and they failed on air once again to cite the original report. And this has been probably within the course of a year, maybe the, you know, fifth or sixth time that CNN has done this to Truth Out, to me,
mm-hmm.
On investigative stories I've published. And I have to tell you, it's stunning. It's unbelievable that, you know, again, this is a story that resulted in the suspension of a program, of a course that has been in place for two decades. It made a real impact. And any journalist will tell you, Peter, that, you know, when you report stories, you hope that it does result in some sort of change or action being taken as a result, you know, aside from informing people. And the fact that CNN once again reported this without even mentioning, you know, where the report originated from is highly unethical. And, you know, I will add that Fox News picked up on it as well and also failed to, you know, to credit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm less surprised with Fox News given their own, you know, issues of credibility. So it's, you know, it's receiving lots of attention, but, you know, we still struggle for, you know, to gain some recognition at times when, you know, in our reporting.
Well, maybe we need to get some of the editors at CNN and these other outlets. We'll put them through a mandatory ethics training program.
Right.
We'll actually exclude the religious themes and just
yeah.
and then force them to sign a statement when they leave that they will
yeah. Yeah.
honor them at all times in the future. Well,
yeah.
Jason, I will link to your stories in the show file at peterbcollins.com. I want people to be aware, A, of the content, but also of the great work that you've done here. And I commend you for staying on these issues and exposing this kind of wrongdoing.
I really do appreciate it, Peter. Thank you so much.
Jason Leopold from truthout.org. Thanks for listening to this fresh episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Follow me on Facebook, Peter B. Collins Show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until